You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Emily Nussbaum, the culture editor at New York Magazine, wrote in a recent article that for television, the past decade was, quote, a period of exhilarating craftsmanship and formal experimentation accompanied by spurts of anxious grandiosity. Shows like The Wire, 30 Rock, Mad Men, and The Sopranos featured complex characters and idiosyncratic and involved plots. Budding technologies like TiVo, DVD, DVR machines, and developments on the Internet changed the ways in which viewers could interact with their favorite shows. So, can we say that this past decade has really been a new golden age of television? Well, Emily Nussbaum joins us now, along with Alan Sepinwall, who is a TV critic for the Star Ledger, and I'm very pleased to welcome them to our show. Hello.
Thank you.
Emily, in your December 4th column for New York Magazine called When TV Became Art, Goodbye Boob Tube, Hello Brain Food, you wrote that for anyone who loves television, who adores it with the possessive and defensive eyes of a fan, this was the most centrally and importantly the first decade when television became recognizable as an art, great art, collectible, and life-changing and transformative and lasting. Now, a lot of people might say, yeah, there was a lot of good stuff on, but it's kind of hard to argue against everything we've just been talking about here. You know, the time in the 50s and 60s when Paddy Chayefsky, Horton Foote, Ted Mazzell, Reginald Rose, Rod Sterling, Gore Vidal, and so many others were writing television plays, and Toscanini made regular appearances, and Leonard Bernstein had his own television show, et cetera, et cetera.
There is no doubt that that period was a golden age of television in the sense that it was the first golden age of television. It was an entirely different period in television because nobody was watching it at the time. It was a place for high art. There was a whole different phenomenon going on. I'm not disagreeing with that. What I was reacting against was basically what came afterwards, what you were discussing at the end of the conversation, which is the transformation after the period when those great teleplays and the opportunity for television to be a stage for all sorts of very complicated mixture of like mass viewership for high art kind of passed. I'm not saying there wasn't great television in the past in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s either, but it's hard to deny that that period was a period in which, in all sorts of complicated ways, television was regarded as having moments of great excitement, of even of aesthetic ambition, a huge impact on the culture, but it was also regarded as, you know, these classic quotes, the vast wasteland, chewing gum for the eyes. And even somewhat ambitious shows that came along had a much more, you know, complicated mixture of commercial and artistic relationship with the audience. And, you know, basically people who worked on television knew it was there to sell soap. I actually do feel that the last decade stands out from that in very complicated ways, some of which have to do with technology, some of which have to do with the people who were making the television shows.
Of course, this is also the decade of Survivor, American Idol, Who Wants to Marry a Millionaire, and a lot of other shows that people might consider to represent a kind of a low point.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with that as well. I mean, it was one of the thrilling things about being, you know, we had in our magazine an opportunity, each of the critics, to write about what was the last decade like for the art form that we talk about. And for me, I was like, television, the last decade, is the most amazing thing to talk about because everything changed in it, including you could write a whole essay just about the rise of reality television. You could write a whole essay about the changes in technology. You could write a whole essay about the economics of television and how radically that changed because of cable, because of the dissolution of the advertising model. But what I chose to focus on was a specific thing, which was the rise of a certain kind of television show that I do see as, you know, quantifiably different than what had come before. Shows like The Wire that had just a tremendous ambition and were sort of a response to decades of procedural television shows.
Alan, you wrote in a column for the Star Ledger called Best of the Zero Zeros in TV that looking back over the best shows of the Zero Zeros, they collectively leave their 90s counterparts in the dust. So did something happen when we entered the new millennium?
Yeah, what happened was the audience became a little more fragmented, and that dichotomy that Emily was talking about before, about trying to do art but also trying to sell soap and attract as large an audience as possible, went away because you're not going to get, for the most part, as big an audience as before. And so you can target more to the niche. You can, you know, trust your audience's intelligence more than before. And you can do a show like The Wire as opposed to, you know, a show in the 90s like Homicide with a lot of the same people in the same setting, but which had to be much more procedural, more self-contained, a little more bite-sized.
But The Wire, 6 Feet Under, The Sopranos, Mad Men, they're all cable shows. Homicide was a network show. And I would think that that would have been a major factor. The Wire can do all sorts of things because it's on pay TV.
It isn't censored. It is a major factor, but there were breakthroughs on network television as well. I mean, they do have to be seen in a different economic context. You can do different things with an audience where you can have all sorts of adult violence and sex, among other things, and adult themes. But, you know, network television, at least on the weblets, is where Joss Whedon's Buffy the Vampire Slayer came from. And a lot of shows that came out of that, which were not as highly regarded as far as winning Emmys, but to me were equally ambitious in a different genre, a use of what seemed superficially like a juvenile form, but for very deep and complex philosophical purposes. I see these two things, like David Chase and The Sopranos and that whole breed of shows that came afterwards, and Joss Whedon with Buffy, I see them as sort of two strains of ambitious television. But there was a lot of great sitcoms, and almost all of them are on network. I mean, 30 Rock and The Office are on network television. As much of a wreck as network television can be, those shows do a lot of very sophisticated things that didn't come before.
Of course, The Office is really just a knockoff of a British television show, but that's a whole other matter.
The first six episodes were, but you have to see them as different things. The American Office does ambitious, humanistic things in a very different light than the undeniably brilliant and caustic British version.
Ellen, you began working for the Star Ledger 13 years ago. What do you consider to be the best shows on television in 1996?
In 1996, the best shows in TV were probably, it's going back a ways, I would say NYPD Blue, Homicide, ER on the drama side. Seinfeld was still the best comedy by far.
So to some degree, these are shows that point the way to what you're praising now, aren't they? Seinfeld leads to...
It's complicated. I mean, I don't know how you feel about this, Alan, but like when I look at older ERs, I mean, I'm very fascinated by shows that are the model for the medical and legal procedurals nowadays, because there were certain things that seemed like really big breakthroughs, like a bunch of overlapping stories and stuff like that, that are by now TV conventions. And so when you see the more ambitious shows on cable, they really do seem like they're a different breed. They don't do a lot of the things that, they take a lot of those forms and they really bust them open and actually use them for, to me, slightly higher purposes. I don't see them as one and the same, although Seinfeld certainly does hold up.
And Seinfeld does lead to Curb in the same way that Homicide led to The Wire. But, I mean, I think all shows build on shows that came before. You wouldn't have had, you know, NYPD Blue and Homicide without Hill Street Blues and St. Elsewhere in the 80s. They're, you know, we just have these quantum leaps every 10 years or so.
I think the difference is just that there was the sheer quantity of good stuff that came out, and in a variety of different areas. I mean, a lot of people when the essay that I wrote came out said, but what about The X-Files and what about Twin Peaks? It's absolutely true. Those shows were incredibly influential and powerful, but Twin Peaks, when it came out, was the only show like that. It was the only auteurist, weird, dreamlike, filmic show. It came out, it was a sensation, it went away. When you look at this decade, almost every single year, there were at least 7, 8, 10, 12 shows that were all doing those kinds of individual voice things.
My guests are Emily Nussbaum, the culture editor of New York Magazine, and Alan Sepinwall, TV critic for the Star Ledger. We are talking about whether we are living in a current golden age of television. Alan, you actually compiled a list of favorite reality shows from the decade. You liked American Idol and The Amazing Race, among others. As entertainment or as art?
I would say more as entertainment than as art, but I mean, there should be room on TV for both. You know, in the golden age, you know, of Patty Chayefsky, there was also Queen for a Day. You know, I mean, it's not like this is anything new. It's just some of these forms went away for a while.
Can you talk about why you chose shows like Friday Night Lights, Battlestar Galactica, and Deadwood as some of your favorite dramas of the decade?
Well, Friday Night Lights is a really good example because that's a show that was made on a network that has the cable values that Emily's been talking about. It's very intimate. It holds things close to the vest. It demands things of the viewers in terms of not spelling things out for them. and the emotions of it are so raw and so out there, it doesn't hold anything back. And now it's become sort of this hybrid where it airs a little bit on satellite TV and then a little bit on network.
Yeah, because nobody understood what to do with it, or because it just didn't attract a wide enough audience?
It didn't attract a wide enough audience. It has that problem where people who don't like football are not going to watch a show about football, even though it's the exact sort of show they would love. And people who love football are not necessarily going to watch a relationship drama.
Well, one of the comedies that you listed was Freaks and Geeks, and that lasted only one season, although it did develop a strong cult following, which is not unusual. We've had any number of shows that have developed strong cult followings, even though they didn't last very long.
It didn't last very long, and yet all the people who were on it are now some of the most powerful and successful people in the movie comedy business, like Judd Apatow and Seth Rogen. And they're basically doing on the big screen exactly what they were doing 10 years ago on Freaks and Geeks.
We don't have a lot of time, but I would like to talk a bit about how advances in technology have shaped TV's transformation in the 2000s, because we were talking earlier about the old golden age where there was very little technological, and so everything had to be done live. Now, nothing has to be done live or watched when it's actually broadcast.
I feel like this is absolutely central to discussing television in the decade. You literally can't divide the things. The way that people were able to write this decade was partially determined by the fact that there were technologies like DVDs that allowed somebody to recommend a show a year later and beg and harass their friend to watch it and to get the whole set and watch it in one day. That was impossible in the past. But there's also the fact that people discuss and analyze television online and have since early in the decade. Actually, Freaks and Geeks was one of the early shows where the creators of the show got online and solicited their own cult audience to go back and forth about the ideas they had, which has been a very complicated thing this decade. But the rise of the informed, passionate, sometimes crazed fanhood online, treating television as something about which they have high standards, is actually a really important and valuable thing. And then there are DVRs that enable people to pause, rewind, and regard shows as something to immerse themselves in instead of something that just pours into their living room.
And now there are some shows, if you on cable, where you might come in 5 minutes late and you could just push a little button and see the show from its beginning, even if it's a live news show.
Yeah, I mean, it's so funny. A lot of technological things are so difficult to explain to people until they have them, and then suddenly everything changes. I mean, TiVo was like that for me when I got it. I just suddenly was like, my whole relationship with my expectations of the way I watch, the way I think about, the way I discuss television really changed because I was able to have it automatically record what I wanted to and not just wander in and out of the room as it came on.
Alan, a listener asks, what about the end of the laugh track for comedies?
That's been a very, very beneficial thing, I think, because this notion that people have to be told when to laugh. I mean, the common thread that's running through all these great comedies and these dramas we've been talking about is that they respect the audience's intelligence. They assume you're going to figure things out, and that includes whether or not a joke is funny.
Now, many people have suggested that network television is going to die, that the trend is elsewhere. That the internet will be the future of television, in fact. How do you see it? I'll begin with you, Alan, then Emily.
I think it's irrefutable that the audience is shrinking. It's going to keep on shrinking. And then the question becomes, how do you pay for this stuff? A show like Lost is tremendously expensive. And HBO and AMC and FX have found ways to do things a little bit cheaper. But there may come a point where the audience is so small that they're just not going to be able to justify it. And I wonder what's going to happen at that point.
Yeah, I'm not enough of a business person to be good at prognosticating about what will happen next.
Yeah, but you've heard the concerns.
But
I
actually do think it's a real wild west out there. Like when I went to the upfronts earlier this year, I mean, people just don't know. They're just throwing spaghetti against the wall to figure out a new way to pay for things. But I do feel like online distribution of television is an extremely promising idea. Partially because it really does potentially cut out the middleman. Creators would be able to sell directly to their most passionate fan bases. And while you probably wouldn't be able to create the sorts of expensive things that only a network structure seems to allow, at least so far, because technology is less expensive even to make television shows, I see the potential for a real indie TV kind of renaissance in the next couple of years.
Well, during the 50s, some of these shows wound up being adapted into movies. Today, what we're seeing instead is shows that have ended their runs, like Sex and the City or earlier Star Trek, becoming successful movie franchises. Is that because that's the only way you can go further?
I think part of it is just that TV has in many ways supplanted the movie's roles of creating adult entertainment. Most movies are designed, you know, to appeal to a 14-year-old boy. And you know, so shows like The Sopranos and Sex and the City filled a role that you would have seen in a feature film in the 80s and the 90s. And so every now and then you realize, hey, we can take this show and make a lot of money on it by putting it in the theater for a while.
Yeah, I strongly agree with that. I actually don't think it's a matter of, you know, movies are the next step, let's take it further. I see it as the opposite, which is every once in a while there's a fluky situation where somebody can get an extra payday from making a movie, but sometimes the movie's not as good as the show, as in the case of Sex and the City.
Emily Nussbaum is the culture editor at New York Magazine, and Alan Sepinwall is TV critic for the Star Ledger. Thank you so much for being on our show today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hey, Alan.